died of some bad vapours while she was cutting a string of bulbs. Many years later, when she began to feel she was the equal of her great-grandmother, Fernanda doubted her childhood vision, but her mother scolded her disbelief. "We are immensely rich and powerful," she told her. "One day you will be a queen." She believed it, even though they were sitting at the long table with a linen tablecloth and silver service to have a cup of watered chocolate and a sweet bun. Until the day of her wedding, she dreamed about a legendary kingdom, in spite of the fact that her father, Don Fernando, had to mortgage the house in order to buy her trousseau. It was not innocence or delusions of grandeur. That was how they had brought her up. Since she had the use of reason, she remembered having done her duty in a gold pot with the family crest on it. She left the house for the first time at the age of 12, in a coach and horses that had to travel only 2 blocks to take her to the convent. Her classmates were surprised that she sat apart from them, in a chair with a very high back, and that she would not even mingle with them during recess. "She's different," the nuns would explain. "She's going to be a queen." Her schoolmates believed this because she was already the most beautiful, distinguished, and discreet girl they had ever seen. At the end of 8 years, after having learned to write Latin poetry, play the clavichord, talk about falconry with gentlemen and apologetics with archbishops, discuss affairs of state with foreign rulers and affairs of God with the Pope, she returned to her parents' home to weave funeral wreaths. She found it despoiled. All that was left was the furniture that was absolutely necessary, the silver candelabra and table service, for the everyday utensils had been sold one by one to underwrite the costs of her education. Her mother had succumbed to 5 o'clock fever. Her father, Don Fernando, dressed in black with a stiff collar and a gold watch chain, would give her a silver coin on Mondays for the household expenses, and the funeral wreaths finished the week before would be taken away. He spent most of his time shut up in his study, and the few times that he went out, he would return to recite the rosary with her. She had intimate friendships with no one. She had never heard mention of the wars that were bleeding the country. She continued her piano lessons at 3 in the afternoon. She had even begun to lose the illusion of being a queen when 2 peremptory raps of the knocker sounded at the door, and she opened it to a well-groomed military officer with ceremonious manners, who had a scar on his cheek and a gold medal on his chest. He closeted himself with her father in the study. 2 hours later, her father came to get her in the sewing room. "Get your things together," he told her. "You have to take a long trip." That was how they took her to Macondo. In one single day, with a brutal slap, life threw on top of her the whole weight of a reality that her parents had kept hidden from her for many years. When she returned home, she shut herself up in her room to weep, indifferent to Don Fernando's pleas and explanations as he tried to erase the scars of that strange joke. She had sworn to herself never to leave her bedroom until she died, when Aureliano Segundo came to get her. It was an act of impossible fate, because in the confusion of her indignation, in the fury of her shame, she had lied to him so that he would never know her real identity. The only real clues that Aureliano Segundo had when he left to look for her were her unmistakable Highland accent and her trade as a weaver of funeral wreaths. He searched for her without cease, with the fierce temerity with which José Arcadio Buendía had crossed the mountains to found Macondo, with the blind pride with which Colonel Aureliano Buendía had undertaken his fruitless wars, with the mad tenacity with which Ursula watched over the survival of the line. Aureliano Segundo looked for Fernanda, without a single moment of respite. When he asked where they sold funeral wreaths, they took him from house to house, so that he could choose the best ones. When he asked for the most beautiful woman who had ever been seen on this earth, all the women brought him their daughters. He became lost in misty byways, in times reserved for oblivion, in labyrinths of disappointment. He crossed a yellow plain where the echo repeated one's thoughts, and where anxiety brought on premonitory mirages. After sterile weeks, he came to an unknown city where all the bells were tolling a dirge. Although he had never seen them, and no one had ever described them to him, he immediately recognized the walls eaten away by bone salt, the broken-down wooden balconies gutted by fungus, and nailed to the outside door, almost erased by rain, the saddest cardboard sign in the world. funeral wreaths for sale. From that moment until the icy morning when Fernanda left her house under the care of the Mother Superior, there was barely enough time for the nuns to sew her trousseau and in six trunks put the candelabra, the silver service, and the gold chamber pot, along with the countless and useless remains of a family catastrophe that had been 2 centuries late in its fulfillment. Don Fernando declined the invitation to go along. He promised to go later, when he had cleared up his affairs, and from the moment when he gave his daughter his blessing, he shut himself up in his study again, to write out the announcements with mournful sketches and the family coat of arms, which would be the first human contact that Fernanda and her father would have had in all their lives. That was the real date of her birth for her. For Aureliano II, it was almost simultaneously the beginning and the end of happiness. Fernanda carried a delicate calendar with small golden keys, on which her spiritual advisor had marked in purple ink the dates of venereal abstinence. Not counting Holy Week, Sundays, holy days of obligation, first Fridays, retreats, sacrifices, and cyclical impediments, her effective year was reduced to 42 days that were spread out through a web of purple crosses. Aureliano II, convinced that time would break up that hostile network, prolonged the wedding celebration beyond the expected time. Tired of throwing out so many empty brandy and champagne bottles so that they would not clutter up the house, and at the same time intrigued by the fact that the newlyweds slept at different times and in separate rooms while the fireworks and music and the slaughtering of cattle went on, Ursula remembered her own experience and wondered whether Fernanda might have a chastity belt too, which would sooner or later provoke jokes in the town and give rise to a tragedy. But Fernanda confessed to her that she was just letting 2 weeks go by before allowing the first contact with her husband. Indeed, when the period was over, she opened her bedroom with a resignation worthy of an expiatory victim, and Aureliano II saw the most beautiful woman on earth, with her glorious eyes of a frightened animal and her long, copper-coloured hair spread out across the pillow. He was so fascinated with that vision that it took him a moment to realize that Fernanda was wearing a white nightgown that reached down to her ankles, with long sleeves and with a large, round buttonhole, delicately trimmed, at the level of her lower stomach. Aureliano II could not suppress an explosion of laughter. "That's the most obscene thing I've ever seen in my life," he shouted with a laugh that rang through the house. "I married a sister of charity." A month later, unsuccessful in getting his wife to take off her nightgown, he had the picture taken of Petra Cotes dressed as a queen. Later on, when he succeeded in getting Fernanda to come back home, she gave in to his urges in the fever of reconciliation, but she could not give him the repose he had dreamed about when he went to fetch her in the city with the 32 belfries. Aureliano II found only a deep feeling of desolation in her. One night, a short time before their first child was born, Fernanda realized that her husband had returned in secret to the bed of Petra Cotes. "That's what happened," he admitted, and he explained in a tone of prostrated resignation, "I had to do it so that the animals would keep on breeding." He needed a little time to convince her about such a strange expedient, but when he finally did so, by means of proofs that seemed irrefutable, the only promise that Fernanda demanded from him was that he should not be surprised by death in his concubine's bed. In that way, the three of them continued living without bothering each other. Aureliano II, punctual and loving with both of them, Petra Cotes, strutting because of the reconciliation, and Fernanda, pretending that she did not know the truth. The pact did not succeed, however, in incorporating Fernanda into the family. Ursula insisted in vain that she take off the woolen ruff, which she would have on when she got up from making love, and which made the neighbours whisper. She could not convince her to use the bathroom or the night lavatory, and sell the gold chamber pot to Colonel Aureliano Buendia, so that he could convert it into little fishes. Amaranta felt so uncomfortable with her defective diction and her habit of using euphemisms to designate everything that she would always speak gibberish in front of her. "Thifisif," she would say, "ifisif, onifos, ofosif, thofosif, husufu, cantantant, statantand, vefesef, smufumalu, ofosif, therisi, Alphison Schifficifit. One day, irritated by the mockery, Fernando wanted to know what Amaranta was saying, and she did not use euphemisms in answering her. I was saying, she told her, that you're one of those people who mix up their ass and their ashes. From that time on, they did not speak to each other again. When circumstances demanded it, they would send notes. In spite of the visible hostility of the family, Fernanda did not give up her drive to impose the customs of her ancestors. She put an end to the custom of eating in the kitchen, and whenever anyone was hungry, and she imposed the obligation of doing it at regular hours at the large table in the dining room, covered with a linen cloth, and with silver candlesticks and table service. The solemnity of an act which Ursula had considered the most simple one of daily life created a tense atmosphere, against which the silent José Arcadio II rebelled before anyone else. But the custom was imposed, the same as that of reciting the rosary before dinner, and it drew the attention of the neighbours, who soon spread the rumour that the Buendias did not sit down to the table like other mortals, but had changed the act of eating into a kind of high mass. Even Ursula's superstitions, with origins that came more from an inspiration of the moment than from tradition, came into conflict with those of Fernanda, who had inherited them from her parents, and kept them defined and catalogued for every occasion. As long as Ursula had full use of her faculties, some of the old customs survived, and the life of the family kept some quality of her impulsiveness. But when she lost her sight, and the weight of her years relegated her to a corner, the circle of rigidity begun by Fernanda, from the moment she arrived, finally closed completely, and no one but she determined the destiny of the family. The business in pastries and small candy animals that Santa Sofia de la Piedad had kept up because of Ursula's wishes was considered an unworthy activity by Fernanda, and she lost no time in putting a stop to it. The doors of the house, wide open from dawn until bedtime, were closed during siesta time, under the pretext that the sun heated up the bedrooms, and in the end they were closed for good. The aloe branch and loaf of bread that had been hanging over the door since the days of the founding were replaced by a niche with the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Colonel Aureliano Buendia became aware, somehow, of those changes, and foresaw their consequences. "We're becoming people of quality," he protested. "At this rate, we'll end up fighting against the conservative regime again, but this time to install a king in its place." Fernanda very tactfully tried not to cross his path. Within herself, she was bothered by his independent spirit, his resistance to all kinds of social rigidity. She was exasperated by his mugs of coffee at 5 in the morning, the disorder of his workshop, his frayed blanket, and his custom of sitting in the street door at dusk. But she had to tolerate that one loose piece in the family machinery, because she was sure that the old colonel was an animal who had been tamed by the years and by disappointment, and who, in a burst of senile rebellion, was quite capable of uprooting the foundations of the house. When her husband decided to give their first son the name of his great-grandfather, she did not dare oppose him, because she had been there only a year. But when the first daughter was born, she expressed her unreserved determination to name her Renata after her mother. Ursula had decided to call her Remedios. After a tense argument, in which Aureliano II acted as the laughing go-between, they baptized her with the name Renata Remedios, but Fernanda went on calling her just Renata, while her husband's family and everyone in town called her Meme, a diminutive of Remedios. At first, Fernanda did not talk about her family, but in time she began to idealize her father. She spoke of him at the table as an exceptional being who had renounced all forms of vanity and was on his way to becoming a saint. Aureliano II, startled at that unbridled glorification of his father-in-law, could not resist the temptation to make small jokes behind his wife's back. The rest of the family followed his example. Even Ursula, who was extremely careful to preserve family harmony and who suffered in secret from the domestic friction, once allowed herself the liberty of saying that her little great-great-grandson had his pontifical future assured, because he was the grandson of a saint and the son of a queen and a rustler. In spite of that conspiracy of smiles, the children became accustomed to think of their grandfather as a legendary being who wrote them pious verses in his letters, and every Christmas sent them a box of gifts that barely fitted through the outside door. Actually, they were the last remains of his lordly inheritance. They used them to build an altar of life-size saints in the children's bedroom, saints with glass eyes that gave them a disquietingly lifelike look, whose artistically embroidered clothing was better than that worn by any inhabitant of Macondo. Little by little, the funereal splendor of the ancient and icy mansion was being transformed into the splendor of the House of Buendia. "They've already sent us the whole family cemetery," Aureliano Secundo commented one day. "All we need now are the weeping willows and the tombstones." Although nothing ever arrived in the boxes that the children could play with, they would spend all year waiting for December because, after all, the antique and always unpredictable gifts were something new in the house. On the 10th Christmas, when little José Arcadio was getting ready to go to the seminary, the enormous box from their grandfather arrived earlier than usual, nailed tight and protected with pitch, and addressed in the usual Gothic letters to the very distinguished lady Doña Fernanda del Carpio de Buendía. While she read the letter in her room, the children hastened to open the box. Aided, as was customary, by Aureliano Segundo, they broke the seals, opened the cover, took out the protective sawdust, and found inside a long lead chest closed by copper bolts. Aureliano Secundo took out the 8 bolts as the children watched impatiently, and he barely had time to give a cry and push the children aside when he raised the lead cover and saw Don Fernando, dressed in black and with a crucifix on his chest, his skin broken out in pestilential sores and cooking slowly in a frothy stew with bubbles like live pearls. A short time after the birth of their daughter, the unexpected jubilee for Colonel Aureliano Buendía, ordered by the government to celebrate another anniversary of the Treaty of Neerlandia, was announced. It was a decision so out of line with official policy that the colonel spoke out violently against it and rejected the homage. "It's the first time I've ever heard of the word jubilee," he said, "but whatever it means, it has to be a trick." The small goldsmith's shop was filled with emissaries, much older and more solemn. The lawyers in dark suits, who in other days had flapped about the colonel like crows, had returned. When he saw them appear, the same as the other time, when they came to put a stop to the war, he could not bear the cynicism of their praise. He ordered them to leave him in peace, insisting that he was not a hero of the nation, as they said, but an artisan without memories, whose only dream was to die of fatigue in the oblivion and misery of his little gold fishes. What made him most indignant was the word that the President of the Republic himself planned to be present at the ceremonies in Macondo in order to decorate him with the Order of Merit. Colonel Aureliano Buendía had him told, word for word, that he was eagerly awaiting that tardy but deserved occasion in order to take a shot at him, not as payment for the arbitrary acts and anachronisms of his regime, but for his lack of respect for an old man who had not done anyone any harm. Such was the vehemence with which he made the threat that the President of the Republic cancelled his trip at the last moment and sent the decoration with a personal representative. Colonel Herinaldo Márquez, besieged by pressures of all kinds, left his bed of a paralytic in order to persuade his former companion in arms. When the latter saw the rocking chair carried by 4 men appear and saw the friend who had shared his victories and defeats since youth, sitting in it, among some large pillows, he did not have a single doubt but that he was making that effort in order to express his solidarity. But when he discovered the real motive for his visit, he had them take him out of the workshop. "Now I'm convinced too late," he told him, "that I would have done you a great favor if I'd let them shoot you." So the jubilee was celebrated without the attendance of any members of the family. Chance had it that it also coincided with a carnival week, but no one could get the stubborn idea out of Colonel Aureliano Buendía's head that the coincidence had been foreseen by the government in order to heighten the cruelty of the mockery. From his lonely workshop, he could hear the martial music, the artillery salutes, the tolling of the Te Deum, and a few phrases of the speeches delivered in front of the houses as they named the street after him. His eyes grew moist with indignation, with angry impotence, and for the first time since his defeat, it pained him not to have the strength of youth, so that he could begin a bloody war that would wipe out the last vestiges of the conservative regime. The echoes of the homage had not died down when Ursula knocked at the workshop door. "Don't bother me," he said, "and busy."
"Open up," Ursula insisted in a normal voice. "This has nothing to do with the celebration."
Then Colonel Aureliano Buendia took down the bar and saw at the door 17 men of the most varied appearance, of all types and colours, but all with a solitary air that would have been enough to identify them anywhere on earth. They were his sons. Without any previous agreement, without knowing each other, they had arrived from the most distant corners of the coast, captivated by the talk of the Jubilee. They all bore with pride the name Aureliano and the last name of their mothers. The 3 days that they stayed in the house, to the satisfaction of Ursula and the scandal of Fernanda, were like a state of war. Amaranta searched among old papers for the ledger where Ursula had written down the names and birth and baptism dates of all of them, and beside the space for each one, she added his present address. That list could well have served as a recapitulation of 20 years of war. From it, the nocturnal itinerary of the colonel, from the dawn he left Macondo at the head of 21 men, on his way to a fanciful rebellion, until he returned for the last time, wrapped in a blanket stiff with blood, could have been reconstructed. Aureliano Secundo did not let the chance go by to regale his cousins with a thunderous champagne and accordion party that was interrupted as a tardy adjustment of accounts with the carnival, which went awry because of the Jubilee. They smashed half of the dishes, they destroyed the rose bushes as they chased a bull they were trying to hogtie, they killed the hens by shooting at them, they made Amaranta dance the sad waltzes of Pietro Crespi, they got Remedios the Beauty to put on a pair of men's pants and climb a greased pole, and in the dining room they turned loose a pig daubed with lard, which prostrated Fernanda, but no one regretted the destruction, because the house shook with a healthy earthquake. Colonel Aureliano Buendia, who at first received them with mistrust, and even doubted the parentage of some, was amused by their wildness, and before they left he gave each one a little gold fish. Even the withdrawn José Arcadio Segundo offered them an afternoon of cockfights, which was at the point of ending in tragedy, because several of the Aurelianos were so expert in matters of the cockpit that they spotted Father Antonio Isabel's tricks at once. Aureliano Segundo, who saw the limitless prospect of wild times offered by those mad relatives, decided that they should all stay and work for him. The only one who accepted was Aureliano Triste, a big mulatto with the drive and explorer's spirit of his grandfather. He had already tested his fortune in half the world, and it did not matter to him where he stayed. The others, even though they were unmarried, considered their destinies established. They were all skillful craftsmen, the men of their houses, peace-loving people. The Ash Wednesday, before they went back to scatter out along the coast, Amaranta got them to put on Sunday clothes and accompany her to church. More amused than devout, they let themselves be led to the altar rail, where Father Antonio Isabel made the sign of the cross in ashes on them. Back at the house, when the youngest tried to clean his forehead, he discovered that the mark was indelible, and so were those of his brothers. They tried soap and water, earth and a scrubbing brush, and lastly a pumice stone and lye, but they could not remove the crosses. On the other hand, Amaranta and the others who had gone to Mass took it off without any trouble. "It's better that way," Ursula stated as she said goodbye to them. "From now on everyone will know who you are." They went off in a troop, preceded by a band of musicians and shooting off fireworks, and they left behind in the town an impression that the Buendia line had enough seed for many centuries. Aureliano Triste, with a cross of ashes on his forehead, set up on the edge of town the ice factory that José Arcadio Buendia had dreamed of in his inventive delirium. Some months after his arrival, when he was already well-known and well-liked, Aureliano Triste went about looking for a house, so that he could send for his mother and an unmarried sister, who was not the colonel's daughter, and he became interested in the run-down big house that looked abandoned on a corner of the square. He asked who owned it. Someone told him that it did not belong to anyone, that in former times a solitary widow, who fed on earth and whitewash from the walls, had lived there, and that in her last years she was seen only twice on the street, with a hat of tiny artificial flowers, and shoes the colour of old silver when she crossed the square to the post office to mail a letter to the bishop. They told him that her only companion was a pitiless servant woman who killed dogs and cats and any animal that got into the house and threw their corpses into the middle of the street in order to annoy people with the rotten stench. So much time had passed since the sun had mummified the empty skin of the last animal that everybody took it for granted that the lady of the house and the maid had died long before the wars were over, and that if the house was still standing, it was because, in recent years, there had not been a rough winter or destructive wind. The hinges had crumbled with rust. The doors were held up only by clouds of cobwebs. The windows were soldered shut by dampness, and the floor was broken by grass and wild flowers, and in the cracks, lizards and all manner of vermin had their nests, all of which seemed to confirm the notion that there had not been a human being there for at least half a century. The impulsive Aureliano Triste did not need such proof to proceed. He pushed on the main door with his shoulder, and the worm-eaten wooden frame fell down noiselessly, amid a dull cataclysm of dust and termite nests. Aureliano Triste stood on the threshold, waiting for the dust to clear, and then he saw in the center of the room the squalid woman, still dressed in clothing of the past century, with a few yellow threads on her bald head, and with two large eyes, still beautiful, in which the last stars of hope had gone out, and the skin of her face was wrinkled by the aridity of solitude. Shaken by that vision from another world, Aureliano Triste barely noticed that the woman was aiming an antiquated pistol at him.
"I beg your pardon," he murmured.
She remained motionless in the center of the room, filled with knick-knacks, examining inch by inch the giant with square shoulders and with a tattoo of ashes on his forehead, and through the haze of dust she saw him in the haze of other times, with a double-barreled shotgun on his shoulder and a string of rabbits in his hand.
"For the love of God," she said in a low voice, "it's not right for them to come to me with that memory now."
"I want to rent the house," Aureliano Triste said. The woman then raised the pistol, aiming with a firm wrist at the cross of ashes, and she held the trigger with a determination against which there was no appeal.
"Get out," she ordered.
That night at dinner, Aureliano Triste told the family about the episode, and Ursula wept with consternation.
"Holy God!"
she exclaimed, clutching her head with her hands.
"She's still alive!"
Time, wars, the countless everyday disasters had made her forget about Rebecca. The only one who had not lost for a single minute the awareness that she was alive and rotting in her wormhole was the implacable and aging Amaranta. She thought of her at dawn, when the ice of her heart awakened her in her solitary bed, and she thought of her when she soaped her withered breasts and her lean stomach, and when she put on the white, stiff, starched petticoats and corsets of old age, and when she changed the black bandage of terrible expiation on her hand. Always, at every moment, asleep and awake, during the most sublime and most abject moments, Amaranta thought about Rebecca, because solitude had made a selection in her memory and had burned the dimming piles of nostalgic waste that life had accumulated in her heart, and had purified, magnified, and eternalized the others, the most bitter ones. Remedios the Beauty knew about Rebecca's existence from her. Every time they passed the rundown house, she would tell her about an unpleasant incident, a tale of hate, trying, in that way, to make her extended rancor be shared by her niece, and consequently prolonged beyond death. But her plan did not work, because Remedios was immune to any kind of passionate feelings, and much less to those of others. Ursula, on the other hand, who had suffered through a process opposite to Amaranta's, recalled Rebecca with a memory free of impurities. For the image of the pitiful child brought to the house with the bag containing her parents' bones prevailed over the offence that had made her unworthy to be connected to the family tree any longer. Aureliano Secundo decided that they would have to bring her to the house and take care of her. But his good intentions were frustrated by the firm intransigence of Rebecca, who had needed many years of suffering and misery in order to attain the privileges of solitude, and who was not disposed to renounce them in exchange for an old age disturbed by the false attractions of charity. In February, when the 16 sons of Colonel Aureliano Buendia returned, still marked with the cross of ashes, Aureliano Triste spoke to them about Rebecca in the tumult of the celebration, and in half a day they restored the appearance of the house, changing doors and windows, painting the front with gay colours, bracing walls and pouring fresh cement on the floor, but they could not get any authorization to continue the work inside. Rebecca did not even come to the door. She let them finish the mad restoration, then calculated what it had cost, and sent Argenida, her old servant, who was still with her, to them, with a handful of coins that had been withdrawn from circulation after the last war, and that Rebecca thought was still worth something. It was then that they saw to what a fantastic point her separation from the world had arrived, and they understood that it would be impossible to rescue her from her stubborn enclosure while she still had a breath of life in her. On the second visit by the sons of Colonel Aureliano Buendia to Macondo, another of them, Aureliano Centeno, stayed on to work with Aureliano Triste. He was one of the first who had been brought to the house for baptism, and Ursula and Amaranta remembered him very well, because in a few hours he had destroyed every breakable object that passed through his hands. Time had moderated his early impulse for growth, and he was a man of average height, marked by smallpox scars. But his amazing power for manual destruction remained intact. He broke so many plates, even without touching them, that Fernanda decided to buy him a set of pewterware before he did away with the last pieces of her expensive china, and even the resistant metal plates were soon dented and twisted. But to make up for that irremediable power, which was exasperating even for him, he had a cordiality that won the immediate confidence of others and a stupendous capacity for work. In a short time he had increased the production of ice to such a degree that it was too much for the local market, and Aureliano Triste had to think about the possibility of expanding the business to other towns in the swamp. It was then that he thought of the decisive step, not only for the modernization of his business, but to link the town with the rest of the world. "We have to bring in the railroad," he said. That was the first time that the word had ever been heard in Macondo. Looking at the sketch that Aureliano Triste drew on the table, and that was a direct descendant of the plans with which José Arcadio Buendía had illustrated his project for solar warfare, Ursula confirmed her impression that time was going in a circle. But unlike his forebear, Aureliano Triste did not lose any sleep or appetite, nor did he torment anyone with crises of ill humor, but he considered the most harebrained of projects as immediate possibilities, made rational calculations about costs and dates, and brought them off without any intermediate exasperation. If Aureliano Segundo had something of his great-grandfather in him, and lacked something of Colonel Aureliano Buendía, it was an absolute indifference to mockery, and he gave the money to bring the railroad with the same light-hearted air with which he had given it for his brother's absurd navigation project. Aureliano Triste consulted the calendar and left the following Wednesday, planning to return after the rains had passed. There was no more news of him. Aureliano Centeno, overwhelmed by the abundance of the factory, had already begun to experiment with the production of ice with a base of fruit juices instead of water, and without knowing it or thinking about it, he conceived the essential fundamentals for the invention of sherbet. In that way, he planned to diversify the production of an enterprise he considered his own, because his brother showed no signs of returning after the rains had passed, and a whole summer had gone by with no news of him. At the start of another winter, however, a woman who was washing clothes in the river during the hottest time of the day ran screaming down the main street in an alarming state of commotion. "It's coming!" she finally explained, "something frightful, like a kitchen dragging a village behind it." At that moment, the town was shaken by a whistle with a fearful echo and a loud, panting respiration. During the previous weeks, they had seen the gangs who were laying ties and tracks, and no one paid attention to them, because they thought it was some new trick of the gypsies, coming back with whistles and tambourines, and their age-old and discredited song and dance about the qualities of some concoction
put together by journeyman geniuses of Jerusalem. But when they recovered from the noise of the whistles and the snorting, all the inhabitants ran out into the street and saw Aureliano Triste waving from the locomotive, and in a trance they saw the flower-bedecked train, which was arriving for the first time 8 months late. The innocent yellow train that was to bring so many ambiguities and certainties, so many pleasant and unpleasant moments, so many changes, calamities, and feelings of nostalgia to Macondo. Dazzled by so many and such marvelous inventions, the people of Macondo did not know where their amazement began. They stayed up all night looking at the pale electric bulbs, fed by the plant that Aureliano Triste had brought back when the train made its second trip, and it took time and effort for them to grow accustomed to its obsessive tum-tum. They became indignant over the living images that the prosperous merchant, Bruno Crespi, projected in the theatre with the lion-head ticket windows, for a character who had died and was buried in one film, and for whose misfortune tears of affliction had been shed, would reappear alive and transformed into an Arab in the next one. The audience, who paid 2 cents apiece to share the difficulties of the actors, would not tolerate that outlandish fraud, and they broke up the seats. The mayor, at the urging of Bruno Crespi, explained in a proclamation that the cinema was a machine of illusions that did not merit the emotional outbursts of the audience. With that discouraging explanation, many felt that they had been the victims of some new and showy gypsy business, and they decided not to return to the movies, considering that they already had too many troubles of their own to weep over the acted-out misfortunes of imaginary beings. Something similar happened with the cylinder phonographs that the merry matrons from France brought with them as a substitute for the antiquated hand organs, and that, for a time, had serious effects on the livelihood of the band of musicians. At first, curiosity increased the clientele on the Forbidden Street, and there was even word of respectable ladies who disguised themselves as workers in order to observe the novelty of the phonograph from first hand. But from so much, and such close observation, they soon reached the conclusion that it was not an enchanted mill, as everyone had thought, and as the matrons had said, but a mechanical trick that could not be compared with something so moving, so human, and so full of everyday truth as a band of musicians. It was such a serious disappointment that when phonographs became so popular that there was one in every house, they were not considered objects for amusement for adults, but as something good for children to take apart. On the other hand, when someone from the town had the opportunity to test the crude reality of the telephone installed in the railroad station, which was thought to be a rudimentary version of the phonograph because of its crank, even the most incredulous were upset. It was as if God had decided to put to the test every capacity for surprise, and was keeping the inhabitants of Macondo in a permanent alternation between excitement and disappointment, doubt and revelation, to such an extreme that no one knew for certain where the limits of reality lay. It was an intricate stew of truths and mirages that convulsed the ghost of José Arcadio Buendía under the chestnut tree with impatience, and made him wander all through the house, even in broad daylight. Ever since the railroad had been officially inaugurated and had begun to arrive with regularity on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock, and the primitive wooden station with a desk, a telephone, and a ticket window had been built, on the streets of Macondo, men and women were seen who had adopted everyday and normal customs and manners, but who rarely looked like people out of a circus. In a town that had chafed under the tricks of the gypsies, there was no future for those ambulatory acrobats of commerce who, with equal effrontery, offered a whistling kettle and a daily regime that would assume the salvation of the soul on the seventh day. But from those who let themselves be convinced out of fatigue, and the ones who were always unwary, they reaped stupendous benefits. Among those theatrical creatures, wearing riding breeches and leggings, a pith helmet and steel-rimmed glasses, with topaz eyes and the skin of a thin rooster, there arrived in Macondo, on one of so many Wednesdays, the chubby and smiling Mr. Herbert, who ate at the house. No one had noticed him at the table until the first bunch of bananas had been eaten. Aureliano Segundo had come across him by chance, as he protested in broken Spanish, because there were no rooms at the Hotel Jacob, and as he frequently did with strangers, he took him home.
He was in the captive balloon business, which had taken him halfway around the world with excellent profits, but he had not succeeded in taking anyone up in Macondo because they considered that invention backward after having seen and tried the gypsies' flying carpets. He was leaving, therefore, on the next train, when they brought to the table the tiger-striped bunch of bananas that they were accustomed to hang in the dining room during lunch. He picked the first piece of fruit with great enthusiasm, but he kept on eating as he spoke, tasting, chewing, more with the distraction of a wise man than with the delight of a good eater, and when he finished the first bunch, he asked them to bring him another. Then he took a small case with optical instruments out of the toolbox that he always carried with him. With the suspicious attention of a diamond merchant, he examined the banana meticulously, dissecting it with a special scalpel, weighing the pieces on a pharmacist's scale, and calculating its breadth with a gunsmith's calipers. Then he took a series of instruments out of the chest with which he measured the temperature, the level of humidity in the atmosphere, and the intensity of the light. It was such an intriguing ceremony that no one could eat in peace, as everybody waited for Mr. Herbert to pass a final and revealing judgment. But he did not say anything that allowed anyone to guess his intentions. On the days that followed, he was seen with a net and a small basket, hunting butterflies on the outskirts of town. On Wednesday, a group of engineers, agronomists, hydrologists, topographers, and surveyors arrived, who, for several weeks, explored the places where Mr. Herbert had hunted his butterflies. Later on, Mr. Jack Brown arrived in an extra coach that had been coupled onto the yellow train and that was silver-plated all over, with seats of Episcopal velvet and a roof of blue glass. Also arriving on the special car, fluttering around Mr. Brown, were the solemn lawyers dressed in black, who in different times had followed Colonel Aureliano Buendia everywhere, and that led the people to think that the agronomists, hydrologists, topographers, and surveyors, like Mr. Herbert with his captive balloons and his coloured butterflies, and Mr. Brown with his mausoleum on wheels and his ferocious German shepherd dogs, had something to do with the war. There was not much time to think about it, however, because the suspicious inhabitants of Macondo barely began to wonder what the devil was going on when the town had already become transformed into an encampment of wooden houses with zinc roofs, inhabited by foreigners, who arrived on the train from halfway around the world, riding not only on the seats and platforms, but even on the roof of the coaches. The gringos, who later on brought their languid wives in muslin dresses and large veiled hats, built a separate town across the railroad tracks, with streets lined with palm trees, houses with screened windows, small white tables on the terraces, and fans mounted on the ceilings, and extensive blue lawns with peacocks and quails. The section was surrounded by a metal fence, topped with a band of electrified chicken wire, which, during the cool summer mornings, would be black with roasted swallows. No one knew yet what they were after, or whether they were actually nothing but philanthropists, and they had already caused a colossal disturbance, much more than that of the old gypsies, but less transitory and understandable. Endowed with means that had been reserved for divine providence in former times, they changed the pattern of the rains, accelerated the cycle of harvests, and moved the river from where it had always been, and put it, with its white stones and icy currents, on the other side of the town, behind the cemetery. It was at that time that they built a fortress of reinforced concrete over the faded tomb of José Arcadio, so that the corpse's smell of powder would not contaminate the waters. For the foreigners who arrived without love, they converted the Street of the Loving Matrons from France into a more extensive village than it had been, and on one glorious Wednesday they brought in a trainload of strange whores, Babylonish women, skilled in age-old methods, and in possession of all manner of unguents and devices to stimulate the unaroused, to give courage to the timid, to satiate the voracious, to exalt the modest man, to teach a lesson to repeaters and to correct solitary people. The Street of the Turks, enriched by well-lit stores with products from abroad, displacing the old bazaars with their bright colours, overflowed on Saturday nights with the crowds of adventurers who bumped into each other among gaming tables, shooting galleries, the alley where the future was guessed and dreams interpreted, and tables of fried food and drinks. and on Sunday mornings there were scattered on the ground bodies that were sometimes those of happy drunkards, and more often those of onlookers felled by shots, fists, knives, and bottles during the brawls. It was such a tumultuous and intemperate invasion that during the first days it was impossible to walk through the streets because of the furniture and trunks, and the noise of the carpentry of those who were building their houses in any vacant lot without asking anyone's permission, and the scandalous behaviour of couples who hung their hammocks between the almond trees and made love under the netting in broad daylight and in view of everyone. The only serene corner had been established by peaceful West Indian negroes, who built a marginal street with wooden houses on piles, where they would sit in the doors at dusk, singing melancholy hymns in their disordered gabble. So many changes took place in such a short time that 8 months after Mr. Herbert's visit, the old inhabitants had a hard time recognizing their own town.
"Look at the mess we've got ourselves into,"
Colonel Aureliano Buendia said at that time, "just because we invited a gringo to eat some bananas." Aureliano II, on the other hand, could not contain his happiness over the avalanche of foreigners. The house was suddenly filled with unknown guests, with invincible and worldly carousers, and it became necessary to add bedrooms off the courtyard, widen the dining room, and exchange the old table for one that held 16 people, with new china and silver, and even then they had to eat lunch in shifts. Fernanda had to swallow her scruples and treat guests of the worst sort like kings, as they muddied the porch with their boots, urinated in the garden, laid their mats down anywhere to take their siesta, and spoke without regard for the sensitivities of ladies or the proper behaviour of gentlemen. Amaranta was so scandalized with the plebeian invasion that she went back to eating in the kitchen as in olden days. Colonel Aureliano Buendia, convinced that the majority of those who came into his workshop to greet him were not doing it because of sympathy or regard, but out of the curiosity to meet a historical relic, a museum fossil, decided to shut himself in by barring the door, and he was not seen any more, except on very rare occasions when he would sit at the street door. Ursula, on the other hand, even during the days when she was already dragging her feet and walking about groping along the walls, felt a juvenile excitement as the time for the arrival of the train approached. "We have to prepare some meat and fish," she would order the four cooks, who hastened to have everything ready under the imperturbable direction of Santa Sofia della Piedad. "We have to prepare everything," she insisted, "because we never know what these strangers like to eat." The train arrived during the hottest time of day. At lunchtime the house shook with the bustle of a marketplace, and the perspiring guests, who did not even know who their hosts were, trooped in to occupy the best places at the table, while the cooks bumped into each other with enormous kettles of soup, pots of meat, large gourds filled with vegetables, and troughs of rice, and passed around the contents of barrels of lemonade with inexhaustible ladles. The disorder was such that Fernando was troubled by the idea that many were eating twice, and on more than one occasion she was about to burst out with a vegetable hawker's insults because someone at the table, in confusion, asked her for the check. More than a year had gone by since Mr. Herbert's visit, and the only thing that was known was that the gringos were planning to plant banana trees in the enchanted region that José Arcadio Buendía and his men had crossed in search of the route to the great inventions. Two other sons of Colonel Aureliano Buendía, with the cross of ashes on their foreheads, arrived, drawn by that great volcanic belch, and they justified their determination with a phrase that may have explained everybody's reasons. "We came," they said, "because everyone is coming." Remedios the Beauty was the only one who was immune to the banana plague. She was becalmed in a magnificent adolescence, more and more impenetrable to formality, more and more indifferent to malice and suspicion, happy in her own world of simple realities. She did not understand why women complicated their lives with corsets and petticoats, so she sewed herself a coarse cassock that she simply put over her, and without further difficulties resolved the problem of dress, without taking away the feeling of being naked, which, according to her lights, was the only decent way to be when at home. They bothered her so much to cut the rain of hair that already reached to her thighs, and to make rolls with combs and braids with red ribbons, that she simply shaved her head and used the hair to make wigs for the saints. The startling thing about her simplifying instinct was that the more she did away with fashion in a search for comfort, and the more she passed over conventions as she obeyed spontaneity, the more disturbing her incredible beauty became, and the more provocative she became to men. When the sons of Colonel Aureliano Buendia were in Macondo for the first time, Ursula remembered that in their veins they bore the same blood as her great-granddaughter, and she shuddered with a forgotten fright. "Keep your eyes wide open," she warned her. "With any of them, your children will come out with the tail of a pig." The girl paid such little attention to the warning that she dressed up as a man and rolled around in the sand in order to climb the greased pole, and she was at the point of bringing on a tragedy among the 17 cousins who were driven mad by the unbearable spectacle. That was why none of them slept at the house when they visited the town, and the four who had stayed lived in rented rooms at Ursula's insistence. Remedios the Beauty, however, would have died laughing if she had known about that precaution. Until her last moment on earth, she was unaware that her irreparable fate as a disturbing woman was a daily disaster. Every time she appeared in the dining room, against Ursula's orders, she caused a panic of exasperation among the outsiders. It was all too evident that she was completely naked underneath her crude nightshirt, and no one could understand that her shaved and perfect skull was not some kind of challenge, and that the boldness with which she uncovered her thighs to cool off was not a criminal provocation, nor was her pleasure when she sucked her fingers after eating. What no member of the family ever knew was that the strangers did not take long to realize that Remedios the Beauty gave off a breath of perturbation, a tormenting breeze that was still perceptible several hours after she had passed by. Men expert in the disturbances of love, experienced all over the world, stated that they had never suffered an anxiety similar to the one produced by the natural smell of Remedios the Beauty. On the porch, with the begonias, in the parlor, in any place in the house, it was possible to point out the exact place where she had been and the time that had passed since she had left it. It was a definite, unmistakable trace that no one in the family could distinguish because it had been incorporated into the daily odors for a long time. But it was one that the outsiders identified immediately. They were the only ones, therefore, who understood how the young commander of the guard had died of love and how a gentleman from a faraway land had been plunged into desperation. Unaware of the restless circle in which she moved, of the unbearable state of intimate calamity that she provoked as she passed by, Remedios the Beauty treated the men without the least bit of malice, and in the end upset them with her innocent complacence. When Ursula succeeded in imposing the command that she eat with Amaranta in the kitchen so that the outsiders would not see her, she felt more comfortable because, after all, she was beyond all discipline. In reality, it made no difference to her where she ate, and not at regular hours, but according to the whims of her appetite. Sometimes she would get up to have lunch at 3 in the morning, sleep all day long, and she spent several months with her timetable all in disarray, until some casual incident would bring her back into the order of things. When things were going better, she would get up at 11 o'clock in the morning and shut herself up until 2 o'clock, completely nude, in the bathroom, killing scorpions as she came out of her dense and prolonged sleep. Then she would throw water from the cistern over herself with a gourd. It was an act so prolonged, so meticulous, so rich in ceremonial aspects, that one who did not know her well would have thought that she was given over to the deserved adoration of her own body. For her, however, that solitary rite lacked all sensuality, and was simply a way of passing the time until she was hungry. One day, as she began to bathe herself, a stranger lifted a tile from the roof and was breathless at the tremendous spectacle of her nudity. She saw his desolate eyes through the broken tiles, and had no reaction of shame, but rather one of alarm. "Be careful!" she exclaimed. "You'll fall!"
"I just wanted to see you,"
the foreigner murmured.
"Oh, all right," she said. "But be careful. Those tiles are rotten."
The stranger's face had a pained expression of stupor. and he seemed to be battling silently against his primary instincts so as not to break up the mirage. Remedios the Beauty thought that he was suffering from the fear that the tiles would break, and she bathed herself more quickly than usual, so that the man would not be in danger. While she was pouring water from the cistern, she told him that the roof was in that state, because she thought that the bed of leaves had been rotted by the rain, and that was what was filling the bathroom with scorpions. The stranger thought that her small talk was a way of covering her complacence, so that when she began to soap herself, he gave in to temptation and went a step further.
"Let me soap you," he murmured. "Thank you for your good intentions," she said, "but my two hands are quite enough, even if it's just your back,"
the foreigner begged. "That would be silly," she said. "People never soap their backs." Then, while she was drying herself, the stranger begged her, with his eyes full of tears, to marry him. She answered him sincerely that she would never marry a man who was so simple that he had wasted almost an hour and even went without lunch just to see a woman taking a bath. Finally, when she put on her cassock, the man could not bear the proof that, indeed, she was not wearing anything underneath, as everyone had suspected, and he felt himself marked forever with the white-hot iron of that secret. Then he took two more tiles off in order to drop down into the bathroom.
"It's very high," she warned him in fright. "You'll kill yourself."
The rotten tiles broke with a noise of disaster, and the man barely had time to let out a cry of terror as he cracked his skull and was killed outright on the cement floor. The foreigners who heard the noise in the dining room and hastened to remove the body noticed the suffocating odour of Remedios the Beauty on his skin. It was so deep in his body that the cracks in his skull did not give off blood, but an amber-coloured oil that was impregnated with that secret perfume, and then they understood that the smell of Remedios the Beauty kept on torturing men beyond death, right down to the dust of their bones. Nevertheless, they did not relate that horrible accident to the other two men who had died because of Remedios the Beauty. A victim was still needed before the outsiders, and many of the old inhabitants of Macondo would credit the legend that Remedios Buendia did not give off a breath of love, but a fatal emanation. The occasion for the proof of it came some months later, on one afternoon when Remedios the Beauty went with a group of girlfriends to look at the new plantings. For the girls of Macondo, that novel game was reason for laughter and surprises, frights and jokes, and at night they would talk about their walk as if it had been an experience in a dream. Such was the prestige of that silence that Ursula did not have the heart to take the fun away from Remedios the Beauty, and she let her go one afternoon, providing that she wore a hat and a decent dress. As soon as the group of friends went into the plantings, the air became impregnated with a fatal fragrance. The men who were working along the rows felt possessed by a strange fascination, menaced by some invisible danger, and many succumbed to a terrible desire to weep. Remedios the Beauty and her startled friends managed to take refuge in a nearby house just as they were about to be assaulted by a pack of ferocious males. A short time later they were rescued by the four Aurelianos, whose crosses of ash inspired a sacred respect, as if they were caste marks, stamps of invulnerability. Remedios the Beauty did not tell anyone that one of the men, taking advantage of the tumult, had managed to attack her stomach with a hand that was more like the claw of an eagle clinging to the edge of a precipice. She faced the attacker in a kind of instantaneous flash, and saw the disconsolate eyes, which remained stamped on her heart like the hot coals of pity. That night the man boasted of his audacity and swaggered over his good luck on the street of the Turks, a few minutes before the kick of a horse crushed his chest, and a crowd of outsiders saw him die in the middle of the street, drowned in his own bloody vomiting. The supposition that Remedios the Beauty possessed powers of death was then borne out by four irrefutable events. Although some men who were easy with their words said that it was worth sacrificing one's life for a night of love with such an arousing woman, the truth was that no one made any effort to do so. Perhaps not only to attain her, but also to conjure away her dangers, all that was needed was a feeling as primitive and as simple as that of love. But that was the only thing that did not occur to anyone. Ursula did not worry about her anymore. On another occasion, when she had not yet given up the idea of saving her for the world, she had tried to get her interested in basic domestic affairs. "Men demand much more than you think," she would tell her enigmatically. "There's a lot of cooking, a lot of sweeping, a lot of suffering over little things beyond what you think." She was deceiving herself within, trying to train her for domestic happiness, because she was convinced that once his passion was satisfied, there would not be a man on the face of the earth capable of tolerating, even for a day, a negligence that was beyond all understanding. The birth of the latest José Arcadio and her unshakable will to bring him up to be Pope finally caused her to cease worrying about her great-granddaughter. She abandoned her to her fate, trusting that sooner or later, a miracle